All right, I call this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:02 a.m. on Thursday, March 24th, 2022. I want to thank our House Records Secretary, Lori Rowland, and our LIO moderator, Alex Beeb, for helping us with behind-the-scenes work here in the committee today. My apologies if I mispronounced your last name. Present in the committee today, making a quorum, we have Representative Prox, Representative Drummond, Co-Chair Hannon, and myself, Co-Chair Schrage. Today, the committee will bring back HB 298, and then we will finish up with a presentation from the Department of Corrections. Our first order of business today is HB 298, sponsored by Representative Snyder. The committee did receive five amendments, and Representative Drummond, would you like to move your amendment?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number one.
Is there any objection?
I object for discussion.
Very good. Representative Drummond, would you please explain your amendment?
My amendment reflects the composition of the group of legislators that are currently meeting about food security. I forget what it's called. I want to say the Food and Farm Caucus. They have their leadership are a member of each caucus of each body, and there is no minimum or maximum number of people. And I figured since potatoes aren't Republican and carrots aren't Democrats and salmon aren't Alaska Independence Party members or any of those things, I figured that it would be rational to have equal representation of all four caucuses of the legislature on in this task force.
And let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative McCabe at 8:04 a.m. And Representative McCarty has joined us also at 8:04 a.m. Welcome. Good morning. Further discussion on amendment number one. For those that just joined us, we just had amendment one moved. Representative Prox objected to it for the purpose of discussion, and this changes it from two members of the Senate to one member from the minority and the majority, and I believe does the same for the House. Further discussion? Representative Prox, do you maintain your objection?
No, that's fine. I think we should just move on.
Okay. So objection withdrawn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Is there any further objection? Objection from Representative McCarty? That's a question for me. Is that an objection?
Yes. Let me have a brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Back on the record. Hopefully, Representative McCarty, we're all squared away. There's still no objection. Would you like to object for the purpose of discussion, or are you good to let Amendment 1 move? All right. Hearing no objection, Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're on to Amendment number 2. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move Amendment 2.
Is there objection to Amendment number 2?
Object for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Would the maker of the amendment like to quickly provide a description?
Sure. So this amendment we've talked about this before in committee. This just adds, my focus has been transportation and the transportation systems, which I believe we all tend to forget when we're talking about food security. We're going to need to be able to transport it around. So this basically adds the Commissioner of Transportation and Public Facilities into the mix of the committee members. And I know it makes the the committee a bit larger, but I think he's an important, he's a key piece of it, you know, as far as figuring out how we're going to get certain things. Like we're talking about a mine up north in the Richardson Highway. I have no idea that highway up there in that area was so dangerous. He would be a key piece to being able to talk about those key points, I think. At page four, it also changes the integrated focus areas from 6 to 7. And the same thing, the added focus would be to improve transportation and infrastructure, such as to transfer, store, and deliver foods. And further down at page four, we had storage and storage methods. Might be a little bit redundant, but I want to highlight that right now, a big chunk of our problem in Alaska is no storage, mm-hmm. and no cold storage especially. So I would love to leverage the native way of storing certain things, because their knowledge of this land and of how things are stored is would be a key part of helping the rest of us that are sort of latecomers to Alaska understand that, hey, you know, this is an okay way to store something. Or alternatively, we could add some money in for building some cold storage areas for things such as milk and that kind of thing. So that's all. It's a friendly amendment. I talked to the maker of the bill, and so.
Very good. And I see the bill sponsor nodding her head. Representative, or is there further discussion? Representative McCarty.
Yes, I concur with this, and especially the fact that not only transportation with the Commissioner of Transportation involved, but also DOT is involved with taking care of a lot of buildings in the state. And some of those buildings could be storage, you know, so having them in the discussion of that will do many different facets to the food security.
Further discussion? Representative Drummond, is your objection maintained?
I withdraw my objection.
Is there further objection? Not seeing. Amendment number 2 has been adopted. That brings us to amendment number 3. Representative McCarty, would you like to move your amendment?
I move amendment number 3.
Is there any objection?
Object for purpose of discussion.
Representative McCarty, would you describe your amendment for us?
Excellent. Yes. So the whole purpose of our food security consideration throughout the state is throughout the state and getting the insight and feedback to that process there. What this amendment is doing is just reminding that the people on this task force are to be from many different entities throughout the state, rather than also we get this collective group from, let's say, Anchorage, and it doesn't really represent Southeast, or doesn't represent North, it doesn't represent the West. So it's just reaffirming that in the language. I think the intent is there, but it's like that, just reaffirm that in the language of this here. So that's what it's about.
Representative Kocher Hannon.
I have no objection to the intent. My question is the phrasing, and I'm wondering whether legal chose due regard or if that's your tone, and whether it seemed like a strange vernacular for the construction of a law, and I wondered if it should just say with regard to broad geographic representation, or whether the phrasing due regard had a specific, that's what caught my attention.
Thank
you. So is that from Ledge Legal or you?
Through the chair,
McCarty.
Representative Hannon, good question. And we did a lot of discussion with legal about this. I even said, okay, do we need to have a latitude line that this representation exists above this and below this so it's equal? And so this came from legal.
Due regard.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So we're.
Who knew?
Is the objection maintained?
I just thought, you know, it was a little flowery.
Love it. Let's see. Is there any further objection on amendment number 3? Not hearing any objection. Amendment number 3 is adopted. That brings us to amendment number 4. Representative Drummond, would you like to move your amendment?
I move amendment number 4.
Is there any objection to amendment number 4?
I object for the discussion.
Representative Drummond, would you describe your amendment?
Got to start from the beginning. And if you don't grow it, you can't harvest it. And if you don't harvest it, you can't process it. So that's the intent of that amendment, basically.
Very good. And I see we're inserting the words growing and harvesting. Representative McCarty, do you maintain your objection?
I removed my objection.
The construction, when we insert growing and harvesting, if we are doing it at the beginning, right after includes, but then we have a sequence of commas, so the teacher me, growing and harvesting, comma, food processing, comma, and I'm wondering whether it should be growing, comma, harvesting, comma, food processing, comma, packaging. So just that the construction is the same.
Actually, I don't have a problem with the way it's constructed, noting that there are two ands before the end of the sentence, retail, comma, and consumption and waste management. I'd almost want to remove the and.
Yeah, they all bothered
the
me.
This is all number of commas. I don't think it matters.
So would we like to do a conceptual amendment, or would we like to leave it up to legislegal for conforming changes?
Let's do that.
I think that's probably easiest. I'm looking to my committee aide, who's giving me the nod. Very good. So there is no objection currently on amendment number 4. Is there further objection? Not hearing any. Amendment number 4 has been adopted. That brings us up to amendment number 5. Representative Drummond, would you like to move your amendment?
I move amendment number 5.
And just sensing the committee, I will object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Drummond, would you describe your amendment?
Some of you may have seen Meg Wallace's memo that came in email the other day that describes the way we have to name the departments that the Department of Health and Social Services is being split by because of the executive order. And this applies to the name of the department that is referred to on line 16, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. It is the wish of the sponsor, the prime sponsor of this bill, that whatever department becomes health is the department that is named, whose commissioner is named as a member of this task force, and not the department that becomes social services. On the other hand, you might want to have the prime sponsor speak to it, because there are other issues with this item. But what this does is, I believe it's after July 1st, it names that department correctly. For some oddball legal reason, we can't name that department today. In fact,
would the bill sponsor like to speak to this amendment?
Certainly. Thank you, Co-Chair Shaggy. This was following the advice of LegLegal, as Representative Drummond indicated. When you look at how the current Department of Health is being split, the Division of Public Assistance is ending up in the Department of Health as it stands now. And when looking at where the different services are landing in these two departments and how that overlaps with the focus mm-hmm. of the bill, the Department of Health made the most sense at this time.
Okay, and then I've got Representative Prox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a general question on the commissioners. I'm assuming that we mean somebody from the department, not necessarily the commissioner themselves.
Yes. Representative Snyder, would you like to respond to that?
Yes. If you look at the line immediately preceding the listing of the different commissioners, it says, or their designees. So if the commissioner wishes to participate, they can, or they can designate someone.
Yes, right. Very good. Was not reading that well enough. Thank you.
It's still pretty early in the morning.
It is.
Coach, your hand.
Thank you. This amendment makes me wonder, and I don't know if LegLegal gave it, when we first referenced the Commissioner of Health and Social Services on page 2, should we change the reference there mm-hmm. and bracket it, so it's page 2, line 16, in that sequence where the commissioners are being listed, and whether we should delete via bracketing on line 16 and social services. But I don't know. I read the memo from Ledge Legal. I did not internalize it, and I don't know.
Representative, let's stew on that for just a moment, if we could, Representative Hannon, and let's go to Representative McCabe, possibly for discussion on that.
No, I actually was going to shift gears a little bit, so we can wait.
Let's circle back to Representative McCabe then. Representative McCarty, were your comments to that same issue?
Yes.
Representative McCarty.
So through the chair, that the on page 5, line 19, is the effective date taken effect immediately. If this issue of the Commissioner of Health split takes effect on July 1st, then would the language of putting in there just the Commissioner of Health wouldn't conflict with what's happening in the current, because it won't take effect possibly till July 1st or after that? And that's kind of a question to the committee here.
Let's go to the bill sponsor maybe for thoughts on this issue. And then I've got, I believe, Representative Drummond on this issue, and very good. Representative Snyder.
Thank you. And I may turn it to my staff, Ms. Wiggin, who has been in communication with Ledge Legal. But again, this was written in a way to reflect what Ledge Legal told us we needed to do in light of this EO. Ms. Wiggin, would you care to add anything?
Based on my conversations with Ledge Legal, there's a challenge in having this bill that could potentially go into effect before July 1st. Not have that commissioner in there when we want them to be in there. It's likely that this will be moot, but we wanted to have this bridge, that switch in departments. And this, based on our conversations, this is what was produced. Thank you.
Representative, let's see, I've got Representative Drummond next, and then Representative McCarty.
Actually, I'll.
And we've been joined by Representative Puckettuck at 8:19 a.m. Representative McCarty.
So to suggest a conceptual amendment, like dual piece, Representative Hannon brought up on page 2, line 16, to delete and social services would solve that issue there, but also on page 5, line 19, to make the effective date July 1st. 2022.
So I'm actually going to interject myself just briefly and pose a question to Representative Snyder. So as I've tracked the conversation, there was concern over page 2 where it lists the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. As I read this, that's not actually an issue, is that will essentially be replaced by this new section 3, which becomes effective July 1, 2022. Is it kind of override? Is it a kind of a delayed effective date of this new section 3, which would override the original section, and that's why we're not deleting it from the bill, Representative Snyder?
Right. Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Yes, so we're trying to account for a transition period, if you will. So until July, we do technically have the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And then the new section 3 says, but as of July, that will change officially. And we want to make sure that then this bill automatically updates itself and we're not left with out-of-date language.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that that clears up the confusion on this amendment for committee members. Is there further clarification required, or are we comfortable with this amendment now? Representative McCarty?
Thank you, through the chair. Certainly like this idea here, we have a food policy council that's part of the executive branch. We have an executive order for emergency review of the food, and now we're asking for a task force to look at food, and I think that says that we're very interested in food. The question with the language and different pieces of this, it's like, why is this so expeditious that here at the end of March, we've got to make this immediate when we have a council and the EO that's looking at the food? And I certainly want the legislative section to be looking at this, But even I heard the sponsor say that as the EO task force comes to conclusion, which I thought I heard it's going to end in September or October, that this would segue on from that, which seems to imply that we don't need to get this going right now immediately. It could even start being delayed till July 1st. So I'm wondering that, you know, with this language here, the transition of the department, you know, to make it just tied to health and not also have two different commissioners from the split show up in this, you know, just to make a term, effective date July 1st with that language change. And it seems that that would fulfill the suggestion of Ledge Legal.
The bill sponsor like to speak to that?
Thank you. No, I appreciate that line of thinking, and indeed to confirm the idea and in discussion with the administration and with some of my co-sponsors on this bill, yes, the idea is that this task force will pick up where the abbreviated governor's task force leaves off in the fall. That said, I think as demonstrated by the formation of the governor's task force through his administrative order, it does take time. It takes time to announce the task force. It takes time to advertise the task force. It takes time to solicit applications, to review those applications, and time is of the essence. And in, from my perspective, there's no downside to making sure that we can begin to start scanning the landscape of who would be good fits for this bill, or for this task force, rather.
Thank you. And Representative McCabe.
I kind of agree with that. You know, I've been through the creation of another task force on the Fisheries Board and the bycatch task force. And, you know, the state of Alaska is like a carbureted engine. You get a crank and crank and crank, and it finally starts. And if we can start cranking now, maybe by the time we need this, it will be in place. It just, I don't know if it's that big a deal. So it's the start date.
Representative McCarty?
So I concur with the fact of government moves slow and the fact that this is needed. I'm just wondering, because of the split that's taking place, is this going to cause confusion? Just eliminate that confusion by an effective date. But if there's other ways to solve this, great.
You know. Okay. Thank you. Well, speaking of time being of the essence, I have told Department of Corrections that they would have to wait no longer than 30 minutes. I would like to get through this bill. Representative McCabe, final thoughts before I withdraw my objection?
Not really a thought. I'm just curious. Line 18 of the amendment. Maybe you could speak to, it appears we're adding one more section into the deletion part of it. In other words, you say page 5, line 18, delete sections 1 and 2, and now it says delete sections 1 through 3.
Insert.
Which is the new section earlier in the amendment.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm just confused.
Good to make sure that we know what we're doing here before we take action. All right. Very good. I'm not seeing any further discussion on this amendment, and so I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 5? Not hearing any. Amendment number 5 has been adopted. The last of our amendments. Representative Drummond for discussion.
In discussing all these numbers and stuff, it occurred to me that on page 2, line 2, since Representative McCabe's amendment added a commissioner, the word 9 needs to be changed to 10. And how do we change that? Do we do a friendly amendment?
We can. That'll be a conforming change, I believe.
Okay. I'm fine with that, but we talked about a lot of people. And
Co-Chair Hannon?
I actually think it doesn't, because that 9 governing board is Alaska Policy Council and the 4 legislators. That's the governing board. Then we start with the list of 20 designated people. The commissioners
right.
At all. So they are not in that 9.
You're right, Madam Co-Chair. I withdraw my discussion of a conceptual amendment. I didn't read all the numbers below. I thought it was 4 members of the legislature and 4 commissioners or 5 commissioners. I totally skipped the Food Policy Council one.
Very good.
Apologies.
I was doing a word problem math on the side. It's the only reason I paid attention to that because they had to.
That's the teacher in you, Co-Chair Hannon. Well done. Any further discussion on this bill before we look for an action? All right. I'm looking to Co-Chair Hannon. Do you have a motion? Oh, sorry. Representative McCarty. Further discussion?
I'll call it brief at ease. Real brief.
Brief at ease. Brief. For a motion.
I move House Bill 298 version 32 LS1398/A as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note from committee.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 298 moves from committee as amended and permissions given to Ledge Legal for any conforming changes. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the report and swap out our table here. Thank you. Deputy Commissioner Good and let's see, Director Brooks, for your patience and flexibility this morning. We really appreciate it. Thank you for being back before us. Let's see. So continuing with our discussion from Tuesday, if you'd like to put yourselves on the record and pick your presentation back up. I know the committee has found this very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Laura Brooks, Director of Health and Rehabilitation Services for the Department of Corrections. We left off with the slide 21 for domestic violence programming. We partner with the Department of Public Safety and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to provide these programs in, these are prison-based programs, and as you can see, we have five locations where we're offering those programs. Now that we have reopened our facilities, as we talked about on Tuesday for programming, we will be starting these programs back up again. In addition to what we had pre-COVID, we have added Palmer Correctional Center back into that mix as well. So CDVSA and the department have been, convened a work group to look at the curriculum and the programming that we have been using, both in our prison-based programs and in the community, with an eye towards looking to ensure that the programs that we're offering are truly evidence-based and they are current and they are focused on our population and the best outcomes possible. So that work group is probably about two-thirds of the way towards completion. At the end of that, we hope to have a pretty good representation of what is out there, what's available to us and to the community providers. And then our hope is that not only will we able to, our plan, I should say, is not only then will we offer those programs in these five facilities, but we're looking to expand the prison-based programs to other facilities as well.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Through the chair, I understand that do I understand correctly that these programs are not in place and functioning at this point?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, with COVID, they were suspended. And so now we are starting those back up. The work group probably has another maybe 4 to 6 months to go. And so it's possible that we'll be changing the curriculum, but we plan to start the programming up as it was pre-COVID. Until such time as we have a recommendation from that work group.
Follow-up. And thank you. Through the chair, you mentioned something about employing this sort of program somewhere else. I forgot, obviously, exactly how you stated that. What is the something else, somewhere else that you're talking about?
Through the chair to Representative Prox. So these are the five facilities where we have these programs now. We would like to expand them to at least to our Wildwood Correctional Facility, to Spring Creek, and I believe we had one or two other facilities on that list. We're looking for those facilities that have longer-term inmates so that they can complete the program. These are not programs that are typically used by the pretrial population or the unsentenced population at the advice of their counsel, so we want to definitely make sure we're focusing on the sentenced facilities.
Representative McCabe, then Representative McCarty, then Co-Chair Hannon.
I'm just curious. Maybe it'd be helpful to understand what the program actually is. I mean, you know, we all see the movies where everybody's sitting around in a circle and a new guy comes in and, hi, my name's Ralph. Hi, Ralph. And then they discuss, you know, sort of like group counseling. But I get the sense that maybe it's a little bit more extensive than that.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, it is. We could get you some more detailed information on how those programs are run, but they cover a lot of things from criminal thinking errors to they address victim issues in those groups. So we can get you some more information on what those look like, but they really do span a wide variety of needs for this population.
Follow up. So just that, so like counseling or education or CBTs or movies or maybe all of that.
Yeah, through the chair, definitely. It could cover all of those things. Okay. There's counseling, there's definitely education, and they use a variety of methods to get that information to the group members.
Cool. Thanks.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So this is the nationally accredited batterers program that they have to go through, the 36 week programs that when someone does a DV, that the courts say you have to go to this batterers program. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, this is the court-ordered program.
Okay. So, yeah, thank you, follow-up. So there's only certain amount of individuals, organizations that are authorized to do this because it takes quite a bit to be recognized to do the battering-type programs or such. So by them going through this, then it fulfills compliance with what the courts ordered. So it's part of them, of their reentry, that they don't have to be, they're being released, but they also have to go through another maybe year of these programs. They can be captured while they're incarcerated.
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, that's part of our goal, is to make sure it's available to them while they're in custody and, quite frankly, literally a captive audience. It gives them, you know, a good focus while they're in custody. And so we're trying to make it more easily accessible to them.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you. My questions are about the capacity. In the other programs, you've given us some data on the length of program and how many we have at each facility. Do you happen to have that available for the domestic violence program?
We can get that for you. I will tell you, we've had some difficulty keeping these programs, having providers. And so there has been some kind of ebb and flow to that, but we can get the pre-COVID numbers for you.
Very good. And now, I appreciate the through the co-chair to the co-chair, but the important part is your name, Ms. Brooks. Very good. Co-chair Hannon.
So I want to just make sure, because I think my question was off answered when you via Representative McCarty, but part of that capacity is, do we only have enough offerings in these facilities can we meet the court-ordered folks, or do we have enough capacity for someone who may not have been court-ordered because, and I guess my presumption is, if you're convicted of domestic violence, then the court probably directs you to this program, but you might be convicted of drug crime and not be addressing that, but you might in the course of being there realize that you've got a domestic violence issue and would be a better candidate for release eventually and a better human by participating. Do we have the capacity to address that, or are we only meeting court-ordered mandated capacity on that program? And then what I'm hearing is, and we don't always have that because we don't always have providers to do it.
To Co-Chair Hannon, that is part of the reason we want to expand the locations where this is available. The way we prioritize the wait list, or the way we prioritize participation, I should say, is based on those who are court-ordered. They have access to it first. If there are others who wish to partake in that program and there is room in that program, we would open the door for that as long as they have the appropriate background to attend, because what we don't want is somebody and we do have this, who is just kind of interested in taking whatever's available, and sometimes that's not the best for kind of the therapeutic milieu, if you would. So we're going to screen those individuals, but if they're appropriate for that, we would, and there's room after the court orders are taken care of, we would allow that to occur.
Okay. And anyone before we go to round two? So for round two, we've got Representative McCarty and then Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, so I'm very familiar with this program, and there's a difference between anger management and the batterers program. And so hopefully you have an anger management for those, like Representative Hannon, you know, brought up, that don't just come into the batterers and take some seat out for someone that has to do the batterers. The question I have for you is that this batterers program has 36 units that they have to do. So as inmates are moving from correction facility to the other, I can see them being on track, and all of a sudden they're at another facility, and that facility may be on a different area of this. And I want to make sure that they're not just doing their time of showing up, but they're actually doing the full program. What are your thoughts on that?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, the first question is, yes, we do have anger management programs, and those are separate from the batterers intervention programs. And so in order to come into the VIP programs, they would have to meet certain criteria, even if it wasn't court ordered. They'd have to have a certain background to enter into that program. In terms of how they move through the groups, they may either stay in their facility if they're engaged in this program. If it were what's called a closed group, they would stay in that facility until they were completed through that program. Or if they were to move to another facility kind of mid-program, they would still have treatment goals that they would have to complete before they would be considered program complete in that facility. So we would make sure that all of those boxes are checked before they were given the certificate of completion for that.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Spraggy. Through the chair, and if this takes too much detail, maybe we can talk about it offline, but for all of these different programs, it's difficult for those of us who are not intimately familiar with them to understand what is success. How do you define success? How do you measure success for programs like this?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, that is kind of the question of the ages, isn't it? As I mentioned the other day, there are 8 criminogenic needs that have been identified as key factors that contribute to someone's recidivism. One is something like healthy family relationships. So that might be where the batterers intervention program comes in. Another is substance abuse. Another is education. There's criminal thinking. There's antisocial behaviors and so on. And so what we try to do is build the entire case plan for these individuals around those criminogenic needs. And there's a risk assessment that we do at the beginning of their stay with us, and again, update that throughout to make sure we are hitting those things as best we can. So really at the end of the day, there are a number of things that we look at for success. One of them, of course, is recidivism rates. But you know, the other thing is what I've learned from even talking with some of these offenders is sometimes the fact that they completed a program, it's the first time they've completed something in their entire life, and they got a certificate, and they, you know, they learned that they could study, they learned that they could stick to something. So that's a win on another level. Mm-hmm. So we try to provide a wide variety of programs for these individuals so they can build up just those day-to-day study skills all the way through to successful completion of substance abuse treatment, which would mean they don't relapse. So there's really quite a spectrum there.
Okay. I can imagine it's difficult. Thank you.
Very good. Not seeing further questions at this time, please continue.
Thank you. Again, for the record, this is Laura Brooks. So we have education opportunities in all of our facilities. We have education coordinators who work with the offenders on placement testing, GED prep, English as a second language. We've started that program in the last couple of years. We also have developed core programming for our education side of the house. Things like computer literacy, we have computer labs in many of our facilities, parenting classes, job prep or employment readiness skills, and then a reentry program as well comes under our education unit. So during COVID, That was one of the things the committee had asked, is what were we able to continue during COVID? A lot of the education programs were suspended during COVID, but many of the computer labs stayed open as long as folks were able to socially distance. They were allowed to come in there and continue working on, say, their GED testing. There was a lot of self-directed learning that the education coordinators were able to collect and distribute to our offenders. And so really during COVID, and with the help of some of these kind of self-directed learning labs, they worked on their computer skills, job readiness, and so on. So that's just a kind of a quick overview of the education programs. But we really do start at the most basic literacy level. And then our education coordinators will also assist them if they want to do something like correspondence courses. So they'll assist with that as well. And then the next slide, slide 23, our vocational programmings. Lack of viable employment is another primary criminogenic need that contributes to recidivism. So we've worked really hard to build up our vocational opportunities for our offenders. And our staff also during COVID took the opportunity to redesign the apprenticeships, working with the AVTEC program, the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, to make sure that our apprenticeships met certain standards, and also that they were available in a variety of facilities so that with population management, they could move from one facility to the next and not have to stop that program or not have to lose where they were in that program. So that was something they actually were able to fine-tune during COVID, to take the time to do that. With our vocational training, it varies from a one-day certificate to a 1 to 2 year apprenticeship. And so our goal really is to provide them with a variety of programming to help them determine what is their interest, what do they have an affinity for. And some of them take multiple programs, which again serves a number of purposes, the study skills and the completion aspect of things. So for our offenders, we really do try to make sure that the programs that are available meet their interests, but also we've learned that from some of the communities that they have things that they suggest we provide, such as the small engine repair. That's a relatively new thing that when we went to Nome and we talked to folks up there, they said, these guys don't necessarily need or want GEDs. They need to know how to fix the snow machine or, you know, the boat motor. And so we've tried to tailor a number of our programs to meet those community needs, as well as just what the offenders are interested in. A lot of our offenders are interested in the culinary arts. And so that was something that we built up. And we're also, we have a grant, a federal grant called the Careers Grant, which provides us the opportunity to have a job specialist work with these offenders. So if they do go through the culinary arts program, they have a connection to a business or multiple businesses in the community that would be interested in hiring them in that particular area.
Coach Hannon?
Thank you. My first question has to do with Lemon Creek Correctional Center in particular, and there's always been a shop that was able to do arts and crafts programming. So, and then inmates could sell the goods they produced. My understanding is that was totally shuttered during COVID. And I want to know specifically if that program is reopened yet, and whether it fits in the vocational training or that's not part of the voc training because it's an arts and crafts and then some people do sell.
It's a hobby shop. So to the co-chair, Laura Brooks, for the record. So we also have a lot of activities that don't necessarily fall under vocational or education areas. And so hobby craft, hobby shop, those types of things absolutely fall under that. The facilities have been cleared to reopen those. I can't say specifically which facilities are at that point yet, but they have been cleared to reopen those programs as well.
Follow up?
Could you, since I know the vocational trainings can't possibly be offered at all facilities, could you tell us, like, for instance, where the culinary arts is offered and where the plumbing and electrical carpentry are offered? Because those seem like pretty specialized ones, but also ones that are going to put you into employment pretty quickly.
And to the co-chair, I don't think I brought those locations with me today, but we could supply that to you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, on the certifications, it's great to see this and highly encourage people to get trade certification training. The one at the very bottom, the barista training, can you define that? Because hopefully it's not to be a bar barista, since we have substance issues with many of our incarcerated individuals.
I believe that'd be a bartender.
Through the co-chair to Representative McCarty. No, that is actually to be a coffee barista, so to work in the many coffee shops and coffee huts that we have.
Follow-up?
Do we have any type of training certification towards firefighting?
Through the co-chairs, at this time, we do not.
I'd encourage that.
Very good. Director Good, excuse me, Deputy Commissioner Good, would you like to speak?
Thank you for the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections, through the co-chair to Representative McCarty. We've looked at that, and there are other legislators who have brought that forward as well, doing some sort of firefighting. What I can tell you is there's a few hurdles to that that we have identified between the department and DNR. Not insurmountable hurdles, but there are hurdles. In addition, I do want to share that we do have probationers who get out. They are still on probation. They're still on supervision, and they do qualify and often work on the fire lines. So we do encourage it on that end, but we don't have any programming internal yet.
Follow?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. So I encourage whatever training can be done while they're incarcerated, so that when they do reach the piece of parole or probation, they already have those skill set certifications, and that puts them ahead, especially if we have a need that's there, that that'd be a good thing. Thank you.
Very good. Not seeing further discussion on this slide, please, Representative Prox.
Well, just thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Just an observation, and actually this is quite a number of years ago when we were in the restaurant business during pipeline construction. And we ended up actually kind of relying on Fairbanks Correctional Center to send people our way deliberately. And we seemed to have more success from the correctional center than we did from the job service, whatever it was called at the time. It was really kind of an interesting experiment. So I think this is an important piece of it to encourage people that life goes on and to let the rest of the community know that second chance is something that's worth taking. So.
All right. Please continue.
Laura Brooks again for the record. On page 24, this covers some of our reentry services. 95% of our offenders release back into the community, and so we definitely have a responsibility to make reentry our focus. Reentry services like these really help our offenders become successful and reintegrate back and take up their responsibilities both with their families and with the communities. So we work on developing a plan pretty much from when they come in the door. That plan follows them throughout their time in our custody. We change that plan when they've completed programs, when they request additional programs, maybe another need might pop up. And so that reentry plan kind of follows them throughout their incarceration time. And then when they release to the community again, we're trying to make sure that they are connected either to employers, to healthcare, maybe Medicaid services, those types of things when they release. So what you see here really is just kind of an overview. Reentry is not a new concept. Mental health clinicians and probation officers and nurses have been doing reentry services for as long as we've been around, but now there's a name for it. And we have reentry centers, reentry coalitions, folks who come in and do community inreach and such. And so there's really been a very positive growth and light shown on this area. And so we are always looking to add services for these individuals and to find new ways to help them be successful. And you can see here that we have a number of release programs that aid in that specifically. A couple of years ago, we stood up a full reentry unit within the Department of Corrections that now has case managers and other staff who assist these individuals to successfully transition out of our custody and back into the community. So
I have a question on that, but let me first look and see if any of the committee. I've asked about it before, but since you used the phrase criminogenic needs and described that family relations is a significant element or one of the identified, I think, 8 criminogenic needs, I really want a little more information on contact visits being restored and whether the returning home program includes, you know, is there some analysis of how often has someone had visitors, contact visits, have they been working to restore healthy relations with the family? Because we know that it's one of the significant things to hold you up, to keep you on the straight and narrow. And so just saying we have a program for it, but making sure we've allowed the opportunity for that family to build that relationship, not just on a letter, not just on a phone, but literally hold their hand. And I'm hearing consistently from people that that's the big issue with the COVID period, that they've been truncated from their loved one and family member, and they may be approaching reentry, but they've had no physical contact and nothing except for a phone and a letter, and that it's not the same. And so I'm wondering, in our formal programs for reentry, is there some analysis of that? Have we provided the opportunities to do it? Have they done it? Or is it separate from the formal reentry services?
Through the co-chair, Kelly Good, for the record. Representative Hannon, you and I talked about contact visiting, and so I did reach out to our facilities. As you know, we are rolling back COVID now, so a lot of those visitation rooms were set up differently for those attorneys and whatnot. The institutions are rolling them back, so we are in the process right now to bring contact visiting back. I think every institution will be a little bit different, but within the next couple of weeks, that should be back to like pre-COVID era. I would say, I was talking to a superintendent the other day, and you know, majority of inmates don't get in person, and that's not, and we don't know why, right? We don't know if that is, there's something with the family that chooses not to. We don't have those answers. That's more on a personal level. But for those that do have that ability, you're right. The commissioner, all of the department believe that that plays an essential role in their rehabilitation and their reentry. So that's going to come back. As for how it deals with reentry, I'll let Ms. Brooks, I really believe they're pretty separate, the two. But bringing them back is important, and we are on the way.
To Co-Chair Hannon and Laura Brooks, for the record. So we do have a focus on healthy relationship classes. We also, during the pandemic, we had the opportunity to review all of our parenting classes, because as you can imagine, that's a real critical need for our offenders, is to learn better parenting skills, and especially if they've been gone for a while, how do they rebuild that? And so we have some new parenting programs that we're rolling out with an eye towards that whole family unit, and how can we assist these offenders to return to their families and be and participate in a healthier way than before. So we do have those other opportunities for them as well.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. Concurring with what Rep. Hannah brought up, also differentiating, like you're saying, those individuals that the family members have been hurt immensely by the inmate and they don't want to have contact. I see 3 different pieces. 1, family wants to be involved. 2, families that don't want to be involved because they've been hurt so much. And then I see codependency type dynamics that happens where the family members feels to still have to be obligated to, and there is dynamics of emotional manipulation that takes place. I would like to see in your standards of assessing something that brings this back to us so that we can say, okay, this is your, you know, scoring mechanism. These are the individual inmates, you know, whatever that percent may be that don't have contact with family because they just family are not wanting to be involved. That'd be helpful to know. I know in the ACM standards of addiction medicine that dimension six looks at what are the support systems for a person to be able to not, you know, relapse and stuff. And relationship is big. And sometimes it's not family because family's like, I'm done. But what other type of positive relationship supports may exist for that individual? So it'd be interesting to see that in some type of a testing or not testing, evaluation mechanism. Thank you.
Any response that you'd like to provide? Otherwise, we can continue.
I would just say, through the co-chair, that is, as you say, information that's collected in various areas when our staff are doing work with these offenders. I don't know that it's in a centralized area where we could pull that data. But in each one of our different programs, a lot of family information is collected so that they can really work with those individuals and create kind of an individualized approach based on some of that history. I just don't know that that's in any kind of data form that we could pull a report for.
Follow up, Representative McCarty.
So thank you, through the chair. So I hope that we do because this is crucial for reentry. And if you're telling me that we're not collecting that information to see effectiveness for the have them reenter, I'm concerned about that. So can you clarify that?
Yeah, through the co-chair to Representative McCarty, it's not that we don't collect it. It's that I don't know that it's in a database where we could pull a report for you if that was what you were asking for.
Thank you.
Very good. Please continue.
Mr. Co-Chairman, this is Kelly Good again. We're going to move on to the next question posed by the committee about demographics. And I thought what we would do is, it was a broad question posed by the two co-chairmen, kind of like the demographics of the inmates throughout the system. So we kind of put together some slides. I do have our research analysts on teams for if there's a question about how the data was pulled, what it represents. Mr. Matthews will be more than happy to address that. But in general, we'll just start with the first slide. Legal status comparison. So all of these slides, we took 2020 to 2022 to give some comparison. This is an issue that is brought up over and over again, as we all know, the sentenced population versus the unsentenced. And as you can see today, we... my eyesight isn't that great. 51% for the unsentenced, and actually that will range on any day and time, week, between 50 and 55 right now. And then the sentenced is running around the 44%.
Coach Hannon?
Thank you. Through the chair, I want to just make sure and reconfirm, because you've got a very small non-criminal. And are those the Title 47 holds?
Through the co-chair, Representative Hannon, those are the Title 47 non-criminal holds, yes.
Okay. And then I guess I just, you know, we know that we've always had a substantial unsentenced population, but pre-COVID and post-COVID, and now we have more inmates unsentenced in our custody than we do have sentenced, and that is not a good thing. It's not your fault because you're the end of the pipeline. But, you know, we have 5,000 Alaskans roughly in custody, and the majority of them have not been sentenced to be there. And, you know, that's a court's problem predominantly, but it also has to do with the pretrial release programs that we operate in. We need to make sure that people who have not been convicted of crimes, who are safe and have jobs that they could be going to, are there.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. I concur with Representative Hannon. It's a remarkable statistic. And it would be helpful, though, to know a little bit more about that. There's unsentenced, as I understand it, includes inmates that have not completed a court trial, and also those that have been convicted and are just awaiting sentencing. And it would be helpful to have a lot more information about that particular group of the population, because it is a problem. Just, what is it, the right to a speedy trial and et cetera, and just to keep the process going, I would think, for the individual to have. Life is going on, I guess, even if you're incarcerated.
Looks like the Deputy Commissioner would like to address that.
Through the co-chair, Representative Prox, what I can tell you is the number that have been through trial and just waiting sentencing is incredibly small in that group. So those, it's very small. It's negligible. So really, those folks are unsentenced in and waiting trial, to be honest. I mean, and we've seen it, by the way, COVID did impact it, but we saw it starting to go up in numbers before COVID. So this started before COVID, and then we saw it impact the numbers.
Quick follow-up. Do you have any, excuse me, through the chair, do you have any idea of those, that's good to know. Do you have any idea of those that are awaiting trial? Are they awaiting trial because they have requested some sort of a delay, or the court system is just bottled up, versus the court system is just bottled up?
Through the co-chair, Representative Prox, that would be anecdotal, because we really don't know what's happening between an inmate and their attorney. Probably a little bit of all. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, there's some that are going to serve their time, and then when they get to trial, will be time served type of thing. So I would, anecdotally, I would say it's a little bit of all of the above.
Okay. And another quick one. Is there a way of getting a more precise guess? Because if the unsentenced population is large, more or less, because they are asking for a delay in the proceedings, and there are valid reasons for them to do that, that's a whole different thing than if they're sitting around waiting for a trial.
Through the co-chair, Representative Prox, we would not have that information.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
As the only member of this committee who also serves on judiciary, I can offer a little insight, not maybe from a professional's point of view, but one of the things the court system did was to contribute to its part in cost savings. And when we had revenue issues a couple of years ago, they voluntarily cut their hours by, I think, would that be 10%? The courts didn't operate on Friday afternoons for at least a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And that started before COVID. I think we heard the Chief Justice's report a few weeks ago before the joint session that said they were going back to full-time because, you know, a lot of things didn't get done. The other thing I understand happened because of COVID and the fact that trials weren't happening as much as they could have been, except for the restrictions during the pandemic, is that accused people tended not to want to come to a deal and get out of jail or whatever the phrase is. They wanted to wait until they had their day in court. So it's quite possible that some unsentenced and pretrial folks didn't want to go to court, and their attorneys didn't push them to go to court. I heard this frustration on many many trial issues, whether they were criminal trials or even civil trials, because of the lack of courtroom operations. People just kind of tended to hold out. So that's not really a professional explanation of what happened, as I'm not a lawyer. And it's been a while since we've had this discussion in judiciary, but bringing them back up to an additional 20% a week, I'm not doing the math right.
10%
a week should help. And also on a positive note, I note that the total numbers of prisoners went down by 143 in those 2 years. But the unsentenced population increased by 157. So there definitely is a lack of work in that department that caused that number to increase.
Thank you for sharing those insights. Would the department like to respond to any of that? Very good. So next up, we're going to go to Representative McCarty, and then I've got Representative Prox in the queue.
I'm good.
Nope. Representative McCarty's good. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. So it's somebody that is unsentenced, and we're kind of determining that the majority of those are awaiting trial for one reason or another. This is an oversimplification, but are they just sitting around waiting as opposed to participating in other programs that are offered in the facility?
Through the co-chair to Representative Prox, Laura Brooks for the record, they can certainly partake in the programs that are there. Depending on what the program is, we might prioritize those folks based on if they're court ordered to attend, based on the length of stay that they have. So for some of the programs like residential substance abuse treatment, for example, you need a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so for unsentenced folks who are in on fairly de minimis crimes, they may not participate in the residential treatment program. But then we have psychoeducational programs for substance abuse that they could participate in. So there's still a variety of things, absolutely, that the unsentenced population can participate in. I will just add, though, that we don't see great participation from that group. We're going around and trying to encourage that participation, but we definitely don't see the level of participation in the unsentenced population that we do in the sentenced population.
Thank you.
Very good. Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you, through the co-chair. And I guess mostly this is to make sure, I appreciate Representative Drummond's insight from Judiciary, but I guess I want to remind us that we can't just blame corrections and the courts. We've created laws that mandate someone be arrested, but we may not have stood up and put the money there to increase the court capacity to deal with them. So 3 years down the road, when there's more pretrial people in prison, because we've said you're going to hold these people in prison till the trial, but we haven't expanded the trial capacity or the court's, the court's ability to deal with it, we end up with more people. And we, of course, do it with good intentions to make our communities safe, forgetting that prison is not a healthy place for anyone, and when we go back to some of our initial statistics of the majority of people who are in prison have significant mental health issues, and if we're not getting them treatment, if we're not helping them with their addiction, if they don't learn better living skills, then it's not improving. It may be creating a decay in mental capacity to improve. And we don't always think about that. We deal with that. We just write the law and then forget. But then the courts have to carry out that law, and corrections ends up with the receipt of it without us going, what's our goal? Our goal is to make our communities safer and our citizens better functioning. And by the time we end up in prison, we know, and I think the phrase you've used is you have a very ill population. And I think when you say that, I interpret that to not just mean physically. These are people who are fractured. Their lives generally have been 75% of the women in our prison have been sexually assaulted. And, you know, that risk factor was identifiable usually substantially before they end up in prison. And now that they're there and we see those statistics, we're not doing a good job to improve society or make society safe when that's where we are. More people in prison today in Alaska have not been convicted of a crime. Yet we know they've done something to draw our attention as a society that says this has to change. So we play a role in it.
Representative Drummond?
One more comment. As a member of Judiciary, the public defenders who represent a lot of these folks are hugely overworked. I believe in the budget is an increase in the number of public defenders, but the salaries that they're offered means they're going elsewhere. The retirement that they are not offered means that they're going elsewhere. I believe there's also a bill, or maybe it's a budget item, that increases their salaries because Washington State, for example, pays public defenders a heck of a lot more than Alaska does. There's, you know, if you're short on public defenders and their caseloads are completely out of line, they're not going to manage their way through this process, especially if the courts are not processing as many people as many trials as they can. On the positive side, you're down by sentence population by almost 300 people in total. So, you know, but the increase, again, was in the unsentenced population.
Straying a little bit away from corrections, but obviously very related and provide some important context. So thank you for those comments. Not seeing any other questions on this slide. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. For the record, Kelly Good. The next slide is just population by gender, comparing 2020 again to 2022. And as you can see, it stayed really fairly consistent, 7% to 6% for the female population. The next slide is by race. And again, this is 2020 to 2022. And overall, pretty consistent in general.
Okay. Not seeing questions. Okay. Please continue. Yep.
The next one is one that is often asked of the department, and that is the population by offense class. Who is incarcerated for what crimes? And so here you've got the 2020, again, versus 2022 by the main offense categories. And if you have any questions regarding this, please let me know. And Mr. Matthews is online, and he can always let you know if you need more clarification on what's included in any of those offenses.
Coach Hannon.
Thank you. And I guess just because, so motor vehicle, it's got to be a crime, but it's, I guess I assumed, are those all DUIs or how is a crime, because most motor vehicle infractions aren't considered criminal, but it's not alcohol related, or is it? So,
Mr. Matthews, can you address that, please?
Certainly. Hello, this is Mike Matthews, Lead Research Analyst with Department of Corrections. Through the chair, motor vehicle offenses, as they're defined here, are anything other than DUI. So, for example, failure to stop at the direction of a police officer. That's probably the biggest one that we have. There's also ones that, you know, the commercial driver's license has expired, things like that.
Follow up.
Okay, now I'm quite alarmed to hear that I thought those were both civil infractions, points off your license, maybe revocation of your CDL because it wasn't renewed. But I'm alarmed to see that you are now sentenced in our population for that. Am I interpreting that right? Because I thought we were not talking about all court processes, but sentenced population. So now, My CDL was expired and I killed someone rolling through a stop sign, or failure to stop with the police, but I'm very concerned to hear that we've got, so help me understand that a little more.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, this is Mike Matthews. Yeah, there are some, motor vehicle offenses that are criminal in nature. Failure to stop at the direction of a police officer is probably the most common offense within that group, but it is a criminal offense.
Follow up.
Could you tell me what the typical sentencing for that is?
I don't have that. Through the chair, I don't have that in front of me.
Possibly something that could be provided in follow-up. All right. Further questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Kelly Good. Moving to the next slide. Wrong way. Sorry about that. Mr. Co-Chair, we included this because while the request was for mostly sentenced population, it is often also asked what the unsentenced population within our facilities and by their offense class. So we just included this for information for the committee. If there's any questions, please let us know. But this was just to compare for you folks the sentenced versus unsentenced by offense class.
Very good. Thank you.
The next slide is by custody level. In general, we have three, minimum, medium, and then closed custody. So this is the comparison again, 2020 to 2022. Relatively staying consistent. The next one is sentence population by crime type, so felony versus misdemeanor. This has been a pretty popular topic in the last couple of years. There's been a concern that there's been a large number of misdemeanors that have been held within the facilities, and I think this helps to show that really on average there's about 320 of sentenced inmates that are in on misdemeanor charges.
Very good. I believe that was our last demographic slide. Do committee members have questions or comments on any of those? Representative McCarty?
So, thanks. Through the chair, there was a time when there was a higher number of misdemeanor, and so the electronic monitoring took place to kind of relieve that load there. Certainly you're not the courts, but it is a question of like, why are these individuals, misdemeanors, coming through Department of Corrections when the court may decide to just have them on electronic monitoring?
Through the Kelly Good again, through the co-chair, Representative McCarty, these are sentenced, so they would not be out on electronic monitoring pretrial. They, if they were sent directly to probation, but we have very few electronic monitoring probation folks. So the only other thing would be sentence electronic monitoring, and they would be within us. And then we're getting to that soon, what the eligibility and process is for sentence DM. But unless Mr. Matthews has something else about that particular group on why you're asking why misdemeanors would actually be incarcerated with us.
Yes.
Mike, do you have any additional data on that?
Through the chair, perhaps the only thing I can add is when we're talking about felons and misdemeanors, one thing we need to keep in mind is that while misdemeanors represent a small number of sentenced individuals, when it comes to being remanded, misdemeanors are far and away the most common offense for remand, for booking. So that is, but since they have such a short length of stay, they appear to be a minority in the sentence population.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Hannon?
Thank you, through the chair. And again, this is one of those I got to work a word problem while we were talking. So by definition, a misdemeanor is something you could not spend more than a year in prison for. And we have such a large percent of unsentenced pretrial. I assume that you have to pay attention to that. And if someone has not been out on EM and they are in custody, but they're only charged with a misdemeanor, are they automatically released at day 367 because the crime that they're charged with could not have held them for longer once sentenced? Or is that completely a court action to take? You just hold them till the court says it's time to move.
Through the co-chair to Representative Hannon, we will not hold somebody longer than the court's order. So,
but the pretrial.
Oh, the unsentenced?
The unsentenced, but you're only charged with a misdemeanor, and the punishment that could only be 1 year. Mm-hmm.
They may be on longer. That is something that is not within our control. We have seen folks on pretrial supervision, so not incarcerated, that may have been on pretrial supervision longer than maybe their actual court. But what I will say is sometimes that works in their benefit because then it's time served and they're done. So I would say that there is a relationship between, at that point, the defendant, right, because they're not found guilty of anything yet, and their attorney, too. So.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
So through the chair to the committee, that's an interesting concept because if a person cannot serve more than 1 year on a misdemeanor, then they are naturally flat-timed. If the court does not respond in an expeditious manner, then it may be that they have to be released, and it releases the burden on DOC because – so something to be explored possibly.
Okay. Very good. Not seeing any other comments or questions at the moment. Please continue into the next section.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Again, for the record, Kelly Good. The next and the last area that the committee asked us to touch base on was community programs, so placements. In general, before you is the – what we did was we listed the three, so community residential centers, furlough, and then sentenced electronic monitoring. And I don't know if you really – I mean, I know this committee is quite familiar with these placement processes. We have our classification officer online. That's Mr. Bran Wade to answer technical questions. And I just – we can go through, but these are – I know that this committee has seen this before. The first, of course, is CRCs, and you know that we have them throughout the state. And the placement process, the eligibility, and then the process. So how would you like to do it, Mr. Co-Chairman?
You know, I think we've got the time, and I'm a little dense, so why Perfect. Don't you walk
no,
us through
I'm
it?
I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wade then and let him – he is the expert in this area. Let me just ask him to go through the slides. Bran, there he is.
Thank you.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you. My name is Bran Wade. I am the Chief Classification Officer for the Department of Corrections. And as Deputy Commissioner Good noted, we have three avenues to get out into the community. We have what we call CRC placements. It's a community residential center placement. And we have a couple of slides on that. And then we also have furlough, which many people are very familiar with. And we have two slides on that. And then the last being sentenced electronic monitoring, which we have a slide on that at the very end as well. So I will use the word CRC placement since we've defined what CRC is just for time purposes. So we have a placement process for these CRC placements. The approving authority is either my office or the superintendent in the facility. And we place all levels, which we're going to go over in the next slide. And each one of these offenders in Anchorage and Fairbanks right now are wearing GPS monitors on their ankles for monitoring purposes. And we're doing that right now, like I said, in Anchorage and Fairbanks. So we have the eligibility criteria here. This is the basic eligibility criteria for those CRC placements. No current or past sex offenders, no arson, criminally negligent, burning offenses. And the next one is no probation, accountability with certain enforcement. Everybody knows that to be PACE. And then no current offense of escape or a current halfway house CRC walk away.
Okay, and we've got a question from Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you. Mr. Wade, my question has to do with GPS monitoring if you're placed at a CRC in Anchorage or Fairbanks, and I'm curious whether that's because that private vendor hosting the CRC requires it, or whether we've had more walkaways from Anchorage and Fairbanks, or, you know, you're on the road system and you could get somewhere, or if it's we don't have enough GPS monitoring capacity to do it everywhere. So I'm wondering why just those two, or, yeah.
Okay, to the co-chair. So we started in Fairbanks to begin with, actually, and we started there during a COVID outbreak back in October of 2020. And so we started there. It was only about 25 to 30 bracelets, and supply was an issue at the time, especially in Fairbanks, to take that many units. And then we expanded that to Anchorage a couple of months later. Right now, the reason we're doing it in Anchorage and Fairbanks, those have, especially in Anchorage, that halfway house, those halfway houses do see more walkaways. Fairbanks sees more walkaways than the rest of the state. The rest of the state does not see the number of walkaways that Anchorage and Fairbanks do. So for now, it's just been those two locations.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you still have access? You mentioned that one of the elements in moving that out from Fairbanks to Anchorage had to do with getting the GPS monitoring equipment. So is that still an element of it, or?
To the chair, we have plenty of units now. We are very good with the units. And I do not believe I answered one of your questions just a moment ago, and it just popped in my head, and I would like to answer that. And that the requirement for the GPS had nothing to do with the vendor. It was our decision. It was DOC's decision. And I don't think I answered that earlier.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion on this? And actually, I was curious, and then we'll go to Representative Prox, but the PACE, can you just describe that a little bit better for me? Is that if you've been flagged as someone that's violated your probation previously, you're now ineligible for electronic monitoring or GPS monitoring, or how does the PACE program work?
To the chair, I am not the expert on PACE, but I can tell you, if you look on the slide there, it does say that there's a court stipulation for us placing them in to community residential centers or on EM. It's a court stipulation. They wanted them to, they're usually serving very short sanctions on PACE. And if there's somebody online that knows more about this than I do, and I sound a little silly here, I feel free to jump in, but they wanted those offenders to serve their time in jail for those short 3, 5, 10, 20-day sanctions rather than being in a community residential center.
I see. Deputy Commissioner, did you want to add on to that or pass it on to someone else?
To the co-chair, Kelly Good again. What I would say is it's a separate program. So because if it's a separate program, you know, by the courts, they're just saying do that program and don't mix it with CRCs. And if you really want more information, we can get that to you later. But that's the difference in why they're not included as a or eligible for the halfway house.
Okay, thank you. Representative Prox?
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage. I'm not at all familiar with how that program actually works and the goals of it. If someone is put on electronic monitoring, I'm guessing they're told to be somewhere or to not be somewhere. And then somebody has to monitor whether they're here or there, or does it work like an electronic dog collar that goes off and lets them know they're not supposed to be wherever they are? How does that generally work?
Through the co-chair, this is Kelly Gett. Are you referring to the electronic monitoring that we have on the folks that are in Fairbanks and Anchorage in the CRCs?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Bran.
Okay. Through the chair. So those that are wearing a GPS monitor, yes, there is someone monitoring those devices. I have staff in my office, a number of staff that monitor that. They get alerts when someone is someplace they're not supposed to be. So what they have is they have what we call inclusion zones. I'll get into a little bit of the weeds here. They have inclusion zones. This is where you're allowed to be. This is where you're not allowed to be. If you're somebody who's working, you're allowed to be somewhere else for a certain period of time, and we put that schedule in there. So we have alerts built in that when someone either tampers with the device or gets out of that zone that they're supposed to be in, we get an immediate notification.
Follow-up?
And then a follow-up, and then, okay, the department gets notified somebody is where they're not supposed to be. Then do they have a means of contacting that person immediately? Or how does that work?
Through the chair, yes. Actually, we can actually communicate with them one way through their device. So what we do first, so if we're talking about CRC placements, these are the people that are confined to the halfway house. We first contact the halfway house just to make sure that the person is actually visible to them or they cannot find them. Because one of the things that GPS does, and maybe this is a bigger thing in Alaska than other places, is it has what we call drift points. So it will, because of satellite usage, it will drift sometimes outside the halfway house, and the person is actually really there. If the person is not there and we cannot find them, then we track the device. We have live tracking we can do to find them at any moment, and then we will send people into the field to look for them. If they have not cut the device, if they cut the device off, then that kind of ends our search right there.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the committee on this first slide? Representative McCarty, is that a question?
I do have a question. So through the chair, and maybe it's going to be addressed later. It's like you stated that for individuals that needed medical attention, that is put on the Department of Corrections to deal with the medical unless they're out of the, and we're not talking about CR yet, but out of the incarcerated areas, let's say, Cook. And if they are at a CR, it's a whole different dynamic that they could bill for Medicaid for their services right away and such. Did I hear that correctly last year?
Laura Brooks, for the record, through the chair to Representative McCarty. So, yes, many of the individuals who are at a halfway house or a CRC may be eligible for Medicaid. What is required, though, is for them to participate in the application process. And we find that a lot of the offenders who stay at the halfway houses don't want to take responsibility for their own medical care at that point. So for those folks, we can't force them to apply for Medicaid. So if there is something that needs medical attention during that time and they're not willing to partake in the Medicaid benefits, that's still our responsibility. We do have staff who work with them to apply for Medicaid, those who are willing. And if they are then covered by Medicaid, then Medicaid will pick up those expenses.
Follow up.
So it's the matter of them wanting to be compliant to that. And I believe Representative McKee saw something that was in the records back where we had a very large expense for one inmate for, I don't remember what the procedure was, but it was huge. And it seemed like, wow, why didn't we move them to a CR facility and reduce that cost because they could qualify? But you're saying they don't even want to.
Through the chair, many of them don't. That individual, I do recall that conversation, and that individual was in the hospital. However, that individual was what they call over-resourced and so didn't qualify for Medicaid.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Brooks. Further discussion from the committee? Not seeing any. Please continue.
Okay. Again, this is Brand Wade, Chief Classification Officer. So my next slide gives you the different types of placement that we use for that CRC placement. So we have a mix of sentenced offenders and unsentenced offenders. I know that's been talked about quite a bit today. So we have sentenced offenders that are not on furlough. They are confined to the halfway house. Usually those offenders are very short. They have very short sentences. Or we will confine them if they have many violations while on furlough. Maybe we've taken that furlough away from them, but we want to leave them in the community, or we want to give them another chance. They didn't do so well the first time, so we will confine them. But for the most part, those are very short, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30-day sentences, and we put them in the halfway house for that period of time. We have restitution placements. Very few offenders meet the statute definition for restitution placement. You cannot have a current or prior offense for assault or anything, abuse of force, and that's very difficult to find. We also have unsentenced offenders that we place in the halfway houses on a daily basis. We have unsentenced misdemeanants, and in a few locations, we also have unsentenced felons. And then also, we will place technical violators. They have technically violated their probation, and we will place them in the halfway house while they're considered unsentenced on their violation. So those are the four different placement types for a CRC.
Questions from committee members? Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, do we ever get communities that are involved in this processing? I don't want to see that former community member who's now incarcerated to return to the community through a CRC?
Through the chair, very, very rarely. I've been doing this for almost 25 years, and you know, where the locations that our halfway houses are in usually don't lend themselves to the community reaching out to us to tell us that they don't want somebody in their community.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Not seeing any other questions. Let's continue.
Okay, so the next slide, we'll start talking about furlough. I think furlough is something that a lot of people have heard a lot about. That's our largest number of placements in any given group that go to a community residential center. We have, the offenders. We don't have to wait for the offenders to become eligible. They usually are pretty quick to tell us when they are eligible. So we have a good application process going. It gets approved by my office or by superintendents, depending on the length of the sentence. And they are also, in Anchorage and Fairbanks, required to wear a global positioning system monitor. And they make up about 45% of our halfway house population at this time. We have here, by statute, the purpose of furlough. I don't need to read through all those, but I can tell you that the majority are in our halfway houses on furlough will be seeking treatment and employment. Those are the two main groups there.
Very good. Please continue.
Okay. So we have on the next slide, we have our eligibility criteria. I won't read through every single one of those. There's a lot on here. They have to be medium or minimum per statute, and AACs, they have to serve a certain amount of time to be eligible, and they have to have no past conviction for arson or criminally negligent burning, same as the CRC placements. There are some behavior issues. So if you've had a recent disciplinary at a certain level for the past couple of months, we deem you ineligible. They have to agree in writing to abide by the conditions. That's an important one to note. Not everybody wants to agree to abide by the conditions that are set out for them. They have to pay a portion of their earnings, which they do. And you can see there we have Anchorage Municipal Ordinances. No sex offenders may reside in CRCs, and no new CRCs may be built or opened in Anchorage at this time under current zoning laws. That is all I have on that one.
Okay, Co-Chair Hannon has a question.
Thank you, and I apologize because I'm going to make you backtrack just to that first slide, because I guess as you went through these, I'm not as familiar with the clarity. I need a little clarity on furlough. And I guess as we describe this, so not everyone in this furlough area are in CRCs, and we're not calling them probation. So they're out of a facility. They're in your custody. So what's the definition of a furlough versus probation or in your custody in a CRC?
To the chair. So probation would be those that have been released from custody and served their time, and they're now in the community under supervision under the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole. Those that are in custody and are in halfway houses, whether it be a CRC placement, a confined, or a furlough, they are inmates. They are inmates serving their sentence in the community, still serving their sentence.
Follow.
Define furlough.
I need you to define furlough, because I'm not understanding the difference then of I'm confined in my community on furlough or I'm in a community in a CRC in custody.
To the co-chair. So furlough and confined, they're furlough and confined to the same place. What furlough is the type of placement furlough is you can go out into the community and you can work, you can seek treatment, you can go on passes, you can go from the halfway house to your family's home for a 2 to 4 hour pass, you can go to the movies with your kids. If you've reached that level, you can go shopping. Those that are confined to the halfway house are just that. They're confined to the halfway house. We have not, either they're not eligible for furlough yet, or they've not done well in the past, or they just don't have enough time, and we confine them to the halfway house.
Okay. So I want to clarify and just reprise it when I hear a constituent complain that the halfway house, these are all dangerous people wandering in my neighborhood. No, they're on furlough with very specific criteria, including what I saw is none of them are sex offenders, but they do go back to the bed at the CRC at night. So they are still residents of a CRC, but furlough means they're going to jobs or they're going to treatment, and they've met this eligibility to have not continual sight and sound monitoring as opposed to someone in the CRC, and I guess it's not complete sight and sound monitoring, but held within the facility in the community.
To the chair, you got it exactly right. Yes. The furloughs go out during the day and work, treatment, and then they come back to the bed in the evening, the halfway house.
Thank you.
Very good. Deputy Commissioner?
I'd like to, for the record, Kelly Good, co-chair, actually, I want to ask Mr. Wade something to make sure that we're getting to the very root of what you're trying to figure out. Mr. Wade, do we have sex offenders in any of the halfway houses?
Bram Wade again. No, we do not have any sex offenders serving a sentence in any of our halfway houses.
Thank you.
Very good. Further questions from committee members? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I forgot the slide, but somewhere, 37. No CRCs may be built open within the municipality of Anchorage. Doesn't sound like Anchorage is too happy with community residential centers. Do you have any background on that statement? Or anyway, could you elaborate on that a bit?
Through the chair. So that was, I believe, from 1995. It's a pretty old ordinance. We had the current CRCs that we have now that were in place then, and we have one more that is now shut down. And I don't know the history behind it other than they probably didn't want, you know, more CRCs in neighborhoods. I don't have an answer for that.
Follow up? Representative McCarty.
I'm
you're deferring to Representative.
I'm wondering. Yes.
Same topic?
Same topic.
Very good, Representative McCarty.
So I have a document here stating from believe the Muni, saying no additional correction community residential centers may be located in the B2A, B2B, 2B, B2C zone districts, B3 zone within a certain area of the Anchorage. So it doesn't appear that it's a blanket statement about nothing in Anchorage, but a certain zone around Ship Creek and Chester Creek and Orca Street. What is your reflection about that? And what's the discussion with Anchorage and these CRCs?
Through the chair. So the location that you just named off, yes, that was correct. So the community residential centers, they're best served when they're located near the court system, near the bus transit system, there are a lot of, so for example, the Ship Creek downtown area of Anchorage is where there are a lot of job opportunities. The courts are located there. It's not far from our jail. It's not far from resources. There are a lot of resources in that area. It would be more difficult to have a community residential center out in the, you know, Diamond area because the resources are different than they are downtown. As far as, you know, conversations with the municipality, I have not been a part of any of that.
Deputy Commissioner?
For the record, Kelly Good, and through the Chair, Reza McCarty, we're not in talks to open anymore. This was just put up there for informational purposes. I mean, just so you know, this was just to let that we're guided by ordinances, you know, code and statute.
Co-Chair, follow-up, Representative McCarty?
Yes, follow-up. So CRC sounds like a good addition to DOC's operations. Just I was inquiring if, you know, the most populated area in the state is saying you can't add any more. If there were to be some additional CRCs, that sounds like it's still open. Just they don't want a congregation of more CRCs down in downtown Anchorage and such. Is that what I'm reading?
Maybe hard for the department to speak to Anchorage's motivations in approving that ordinance, but I think your point is well taken. Thank you, Representative McCarty. Co-Chair Hannon.
How many CRC beds are there in Anchorage? And perhaps in how many facilities or houses?
To the co-chair, so somebody can add this up real quick, but we have, in Anchorage, we have the Midtown Center, which has 24 beds. We have the Parkview Center, which has 112 beds. And we have the Cordova Center, which has 149 beds. And then we also have roughly 13 beds at the Clitheroe Residential Treatment Center, where we currently have 17 people residing.
285.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Drummond.
Follow-up question to that would be, how many total CRC beds are there in the state?
Through the chair, we have 519 statewide.
Okay. Follow-up.
So it sounds like Anchorage has roughly the right proportion in proportion to the number of the proportion of its population to the rest of the state.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, so we won't call them NIMBYs.
I'm not going to touch that one, Representative McCabe. Further.
It's a hard subject.
Yeah, it is. Further questions or comments for the department from the committee?
Are we done?
We are, I believe.
Are we on page?
We have 30? One more slide. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. My choice.
Yes.
And if you would please walk us through that last slide. Thank you.
Again, this is Bran Wade, Chief Classification Officer. So the last slide is just a very, very brief, a couple of brief points about the Sentenced Electronic Monitoring Unit that we have. I will call it EM from here on out if that's okay. The process is we have a sentenced EM application that we process that is approved by one of my PO3s or one of my PO4s. That's a probation officer 3 or a probation officer 4. The eligibility criteria, they must be serving a term of imprisonment, so they must be sentenced. They cannot have a current conviction for a crime involving domestic violence per Alaska statute. They cannot have an active detainer or warrant, no escape one convictions. They need to be within 3 years of release, although anything beyond that may be approved on an override by myself. And they must have an approved residence to be placed in. That also, they can also be placed at community residential centers until they can find a place to reside. Little note here, Alaska statute there, 3320.010, prohibits statutory good time for service on sentenced EM as of 7/9/2019. So those that fall into that category do not receive good time credit while they're on electronic monitoring, sentenced electronic monitoring. And then I also have the fee rates listed there, and that is per AACs that they pay each day. And that is the end of that slide.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little bit curious about the change to to good time for time on sentenced EM. I guess maybe prior to that change, how much of total good time earned in a year amongst the sentenced population would be earned out on electronic monitoring? Is that something that you have generally off the at your fingertips?
To the chair, I absolutely do not.
Very curious to know that. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, following up on that. So a person that's 3 years from finishing up their time, they get on an EM, but they are not counting anymore to their time, so they are forever stuck because they didn't finish their good time, or they're getting some percentage of recognition in this?
Through the chair, so, you know, I can answer somewhat. I'm not the good time expert here, but what I can tell you is that once they go on, if their offense was committed on July 9th, 2019 or after, once they go on electronic monitoring, they stop accruing that good time like they would if they were serving their sentence in one of our institutions. Did that answer your question?
Let's go to Deputy Commissioner.
To the co-chair, Kelly Good again. Representative McCarty, I'm going to try to answer it because actually you and Representative Shragi kind of have the same question. So it deals with the date of the offense. Okay, so if your offense was before the 7-9-2019, you can still go out on sentence DM and accrue good time. It's for the offense that happened after that. That good time will no longer be available to someone who goes out on sentence DM. So it's not when you're out on the sentence, it's when your offense occurred. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. And if you want technical information, we do have our time accountant online, and he can give you exactly how all that works, Representative Shragi, or we can always give it to you later. But Deputy Director Wood is actually our time accountant expert.
Representative McCarty, would you like to go to Director, I believe it was Director Wood, is that right?
Deputy Director Wood.
Representative McCarty?
I'm good on that. I do have a different question.
Okay. Let's go to Co-Chair Hannon and then come back to Representative McCarty.
I guess I would like to hear from Deputy Director Wood, because I think we want to make sure, and I'm not so concerned about the date, but make sure we're understanding what that good time release is and the fact that, yes, you're no longer accruing it once you're out on EM if your offense is after July 2019, but to make sure that we understand what that does and what the impact of it is since we changed the law.
Go ahead, Sid.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Sydney Wood. I'm the Deputy Director of Institutions and the Department's Chief Time Accounting Officer. The House Bill 49, this portion of it became effective for all crimes committed or behavior offenses committed on or after 7-9-19. So as Deputy Commissioner Good said, this is only applicable to new crimes committed on or after 7-9-19 or probation violations or parole violations with a violation date on or after that time. So if somebody as a representative, who said it exactly, but the question was if somebody had 3 years left to serve and they were to go out on EM and their crime was committed on or after 7-9-19, we would calculate all the days remaining on their sentence because the entire sentence had already been given statutory good time. And we would calculate how much good time was earned on that remaining portion, the amount of time they'll be out on EM. So, good time is figured at 1/3. So if they had 3 years left, they would have 1 year of good time earned on that 3 years. And we would have to add that portion of good time no longer earned back on. So they would effectively have 4 years remaining at that point if they served all of their time on EM instead of the 3 years remaining.
Okay. Follow up from Co-Chair Hannon.
I guess
concerning.
it's concerning because I'm not sure that's what we and it's the royal we, because I wasn't a member of the body when House Bill 49 passed. But you can't go to electronic monitoring at the CRC until you're down to less than a third of your sentence. You get a third of your sentence for good time because you've behaved while you've been in the institution. You got out with 3 years to serve, but now you really have 4 years to be on an electronic monitor. So it almost seems that we're de-incentivizing, the effect of that could be to de-incentivize, to behave well, to get out on electronic monitoring, to achieve furlough and go to work, because now you've got to serve an extra year. And if you had stayed inside, you got out a year earlier. But that's one of those, you're carrying out a law that was changed, and it seems to me it's a little bit of a strange impact to have had, because of course we've already narrowed down that the population that we're talking about that we're allowing to go to CRCs, that we're putting on electronic monitoring, are our best behaved and likely most successful at rehabbing inmates. But now we've increased the punishment, and I just worry that it has a backwards effect, that we're going to keep people sitting inside the institution longer because the time clock will be shorter.
Possibly a topic for further consideration by the committee. We are at the top of the hour, however. I know Representative McCarty had a question, and I think Representative Drummond maybe as well, but I think we'll have to take those offline, or maybe invite the department back at a later time to explore whatever issues there may be. I do want to provide the department an opportunity quickly if you have any closing comments or otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Kelly Good. I want to thank the committee. When we were putting together this unusual presentation, I will say it really gave us the opportunity to share with you, I think, a lot of the things you've asked in different ways. We appreciate being able to share the information. It helps you understand what we're doing, and we understand better what you're trying to learn and obtain. And I want to offer all of us, this whole team, the commissioner, if there are more questions, you want to learn more, how things are happening, we would be more than happy to do one-on-ones in your office, come and talk more. We really appreciate your interest. It does really help all of us learn more and be able to do better for everybody. So I just thank you. It's been a really good opportunity for us to share. And this team's really dedicated to corrections. So if we can give you more information, we are here to do it.
Well, I just want to extend my sincere appreciation to the department for answering our plethora of questions, both in preparing the presentation, but also through the presentation as we've come up with add-on questions and topics of discussion. So, and thank you for your flexibility with today as well. We really appreciate it. Thank you to committee members as well for the accommodating the last-minute change of schedule so that we could get HB 298 out of the committee. With that, and with nothing before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:02 a.m. Thank you.